Equity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
The next hour of Forum is about the politics of public education in California, and it starts after Michael Bennett checks traffic, including a problem right now in Concord. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Michelle. They're not a real big problem, but a problem nonetheless. Westbound Highway 4 right at 680. Heads up, there's a tire reported sitting there in the right lane. You'll want to avoid that. Fire crews still working the Corral Hollow Road fire. That Corral Hollow Road shut down between the county line and 580. Still no estimated time for reopening. I'm Michael Bennett for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from the California Academy of Sciences. Visitors can explore the wonders of California and see how big, bold, and biodiverse nature can be at California State of Nature, a new exhibit. Tickets at calacademy.org. I'm Michelle Hennigan. Thank you for listening to KQED 88.5 San Francisco and KQEI 89.3 North Highland Sacramento and live online at kqed.org. It's 9 o'clock.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Guy Marzorati, in for Mina Kim. Republicans may lack political power in Sacramento, but in recent years, conservatives have made inroads on local school boards, often running on culture war issues like gender and critical race theory. Now, some of those officials are facing recall elections. In March, three school board members were removed in Orange and Yolo counties. Now, there's a recall election today in Riverside County and another next month in the Bay Area. Coming up next on Forum, we'll look at what's behind the recalls and what they say about the volatile politics of public education in our state and our country. That's next after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Shea Stevens. President Biden is getting pushback on his executive order that's meant to stem illegal crossings at the U.S. southern border. NPR's Giles Snyder has details.
Republicans say President Biden's move is too little too late, with Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell likening it to fighting a five-alarm fire with a garden hose. And he questioned the timing with the November election approaching. But California Democratic Congressman Mike Levin, who represents a district north of San Diego, told NPR that Congress had the chance to act but hasn't.
An executive action is not supposed to be a substitute for actual congressional legislation. I think President Biden needed to act in the face of Republican obstruction.
The executive order temporarily suspends the asylum process when the 7-day average of people caught entering the U.S. illegally tops 2,500. It's expected to face legal challenges. Giles Snyder, NPR News.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says there's a new set of coronavirus variants that scientists are calling FLIRT. Former White House COVID response coordinator Dr. Ashish Jha says the number of respiratory illnesses is low, but there is concern heading into summer.
There's still a lot of people getting very sick from this virus. They are people who are very frail, people who are older, people who are immunocompromised. So that's the population I spend my time worrying about. How do we keep them safe? The other thing that's worth thinking about is there's always a chance that this virus could evolve in some very substantial way, so that it could really cause more disruption and more illness.
Jha says ongoing evolution of the coronavirus is expected and that there is no evidence that the latest variant will make people sicker than earlier versions. And Louisiana judges could soon mandate surgical castration for people convicted of sex crimes against children. Molly Ryan with member station WRKF in Baton Rouge has more on a bill passed by the Louisiana legislature.
The bill allows for judges to sentence people to undergo surgical castration if they're convicted of committing sex crimes against children under the age of 13. The measure, which was brought by a Democrat, easily passed the majority Republican legislature. It heads next to Republican Governor Jeff Landry's desk for his signature. Chemical castration is already legal in several states, including Louisiana. If Landry signs this bill, Louisiana would appear to be the first to allow judges to order surgical castration for offenders. For NPR News, I'm Molly Ryan in Baton Rouge.
Three-term U.S. Senator John Tester has won Montana's Democratic primary. He'll face Republican Tim Sheehy in November. In New Jersey, Democrat Andy Kim and Republican Curtis Bashaw have won their primaries for a chance to fill a Senate seat that's being vacated by Democrat Bob Menendez, who's fighting corruption charges. This is NPR News. The Chicago suburb of Evanston is being sued for paying reparations to some of its black residents. A group called Judicial Watch has filed a class action arguing that the program, meant to address racial bias and exclusion, discriminates against non-blacks. Roughly 16% or 13,000 of Evanston's residents are black, and 193 of those individuals reportedly have received reparations for centuries of discrimination in housing, education, employment, and income. President Biden and other world leaders will gather in Normandy on Thursday to commemorate the 80th anniversary of the D-Day landings. As NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports, it is the third such celebration held against a backdrop of an ongoing land war in Europe.
World War II history buffs and reenactors are flocking to the Normandy coast. 29-year-old Marco Righini is carrying a 1940s camera and dressed in the wool uniform of a Scottish regiment's Army Field and Photographic Unit.
It's a unit that took pictures, movies for the British Army.
Righini says it feels strange to celebrate the end of fascism in Europe while, as he put it, a fascist Russia is trying to gobble up its neighbor.
We should do more. We should care more about Ukraine. We cannot let Russia do whatever it wants.
He says what's happening in Europe today looks a lot like the late 1930s. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Normandy.
U.S. futures are flat in after-hours trading on Wall Street. On Asia-Pacific market, shares are mixed. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Progressive, with small business insurance for protecting a variety of business types with multiple coverage options, designed to fit business owners' needs. More about small business insurance is at progressivecommercial.com.
This week on the Spooked podcast, Jenny and her family love their new house. Now, if only that screaming would stop. That's on Spooked from Snap Judgment and KQED. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. This heat wave will continue through Thursday. The National Weather Service says tomorrow will be the hottest day of the week. Lows tonight will be around 60. The forecast high for San Francisco tomorrow is 77. In Sacramento tomorrow, expect a high of 104.
This is Forum. I'm Guy Marzorati in for Mina Kim. Voting is underway in two special elections in California, recalls against school board members in the Riverside County city of Temecula and in the Bay Area community of Sunol. The elections mark a pushback to conservative education policies that have sparked fierce debate in districts around California and the nation. We'll be talking about those special elections today for this hour. And joining me are Aaron Alday, reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, covering gender and sexuality. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning.
Madison Aumann is with us as well. She's a reporter for KVCR in the Inland Empire. Good morning, Madison.
Good morning, Guy.
And Jonathan Collins, assistant professor of political science and education at Teachers College, Columbia University. Professor Collins, so nice to have you with us as well.
Good morning. It's a pleasure.
So let's start in Temecula, Madison, where voting ends today. Tell us about the man on the ballot, Joseph Komorowski. Who is he? Why is he facing this recall?
Sure. Yeah. Joseph Komorowski, he calls himself Dr. K, has a PhD in philosophy, teaches at a community college. And he's conservative and really, really vocal about his Christian beliefs. He said he ran to help parents have more of a say about what their children are taught. And in this case, to help protect kids from what he says are social and political theories about sex that don't have anything to do with education. It's not really clear what that is, but he was elected in 2022 and then selected by the board to be the president. And from his really very first meeting, the board began passing these really controversial policies. He was able to do that because he was elected with two other Christian conservative candidates, and they made up the majority. And really, pretty immediately, the board meetings became these raucous, chaotic affairs. There were long lines of people to get in, lots of yelling, and just it got really divisive really fast. And, enough people decided they didn't like it, so they pushed a recall.
and that is on the ballot today. Aaron, you've been covering that election in Temecula, and also one that's coming up July 2nd in Sunol here in the Bay Area. Are there commonalities you see between what are happening in those two communities, those two school boards?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we're seeing it in a handful of school districts all across the state. So what we're seeing is basically these very conservative candidates get onto these school boards. And in a lot of cases, pretty much immediately, like within the next meeting after they're elected, they put in place these very conservative policies, often policies targeting the LGBTQ community is what we're seeing. So kind of book bans, so-called parental notification policies have been very popular. Those have picked up in about a dozen districts. And those are those policies that require teachers or staff to report to parents if a student sort of asks to use different pronouns, asks to change their name, basically identifies transgender at school. So it requires schools to essentially out kids to their parents. So those have been taking off. And so what we're seeing, what happens to Sunol, for example, in the Bay Area, is they put in place a flag ban. So what they did was they basically banned any flags but the American and the state flag. And, you know, they'll say that, but it's pretty clear in Sunol and in other communities that have done this, that what they're doing is banning pride flags. And so in Sunol, what happened is they did this flag ban, and very immediately the community pushed back. And then they are now also trying to recall two of their school board members. And so we're seeing these sort of policies being put in place basically up and down the state. And yeah, it comes from this very concerted conservative effort.
And why recalls? I mean, what's your sense of why opponents of these board members are not just saying, let's wait until November, let's wait until the next time they're on the ballot?
Well, I think partly because they're putting in place these policies right out of the gate. And they're very problematic policies. I mean, these parental notification policies have been, you know, sued by the state. They've faced lawsuits like in multiple communities. So, you know, these are, you know, and they're happening right away, and they're repeated. So I think what parents are seeing and what teachers are seeing is that they need to push back just sort of right out of the gate. They can't really wait and kind of sort of let these things play out.
And Professor Collins, how do you see these elections, these recalls, fitting into the national context of school board fights? I mean, are we talking about overreach here? How do you see this?
Well, I think this fits perfectly into what we've been seeing, which is a trend of the nationalization of local politics, and especially school board politics. You know, if you travel back in time, you know, 10, 20 years before, school board elections, they didn't look anything like this. And the idea of a school board recall election was not only a faint idea, but it was something that would never have these kinds of partisan political parameters that we're seeing now. We used to see battles taking place in school board elections around debates over education reform, you know, which new ways should we think about, you know, investing in a new accountability system, for example, or thinking about ways in which test scores should be used to hold students accountable and hold districts accountable and hold parents accountable. Now the conversation is completely transformed, and we're seeing these religious groups or more sort of culturally affiliated groups or these groups that have more deeply political ties emerging to the forefront, and that's guiding these sort of political contests. So this is quite new terrain.
And these are not partisan races on their face, right? School board members, they're not running as a Democrat or a Republican. So how do you see traditional partisan actors like political parties kind of fitting into the mix here?
Well, it's clandestine in places like California, where you still have nonpartisan ballots at the local level. Now, in other states, we've seen a rise of the partisan ballot actually moving forward in a less clandestine and a more overt way. So, for instance, in Tennessee, they recently passed legislation that allowed for partisan ballots to take hold on school board elections for the first time. But California, again, still abides by the old rules of keeping local ballots nonpartisan. But then when the local contests are nonpartisan, we see these sort of partisan signifiers being injected into the political surroundings. And so one of the major stories that we've seen from what's been happening in Temecula is Eric Trump shows up and becomes an unsuspected voice in this conversation around supporting the current school board president, and, you know, aligning the values of the Republican Party with the values of a school board president. And again, this is unprecedented territory, taking partisan ideas and cues and sending them directly down to the school board level.
Yeah, Aaron, you were there. in Temecula when Eric Trump was there raising money and as part of this pushback against the recall. What's kind of his role in this, the Republican Party? How do you see all that?
Yeah, I will say being in Temecula when Eric Trump was there, I mean, it was wild just because, you know, here's a former president's son is at a rally for a recall for a school board president for a 25,000 kid district, right? Like, yeah, it's not a small district, but I mean, it just seemed bizarre to me that the son of a presidential candidate, presumptive presidential candidate, would be at a local school board rally. But people, he was there, he was on message, you know, he didn't talk a lot about Temecula, Eric Trump didn't, but he talked a lot about parental rights. He talked about getting Christian conservative values into schools, into all levels of sort of government. I mean, it was very much, you know, part of what this recall is about, part of what this community, parts of this community are really, you know, kind of excited about right now, passionate about, is this sort of idea of parental rights and this sort of idea of reclaiming their culture that they feel like they've been dragged into this culture war and they're fighting for their basic culture. And that was definitely the vibe, you know, in the space. It was in the Temecula Stampede, which is, you know, this line dancing kind of cowboy bar in downtown Temecula. And so that, and there was very much, you know, like this kind of Texas, like Western sort of vibe. And yeah, it was strange again to see just that much energy and that kind of energy over a school board.
Yeah. I mean, California, diverse state in, you know, ideology as well, right?
Absolutely.
Madison, when you look at kind of how we got here in Temecula, how much of the story do you think is reflective of broader this, you know, quote unquote culture war issues nationally? And how much do you see made up of dynamics that might be unique to Temecula or unique locally?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's sort of hard to know, but I think the opponents of Komrosky, the school board president there, say it feels very much like a playbook, especially because these policies aren't just being passed in Temecula, they're being passed across the region. And then we see it play out in other districts in the state also. And then I guess I'll just echo what Aaron said about like the parental rights idea really just taking hold in Temecula. But clearly Komrosky and the other conservative members of the board have had a lot of resonance in Temecula and across the region. So, yeah.
And was this recall initially, did this target more than Komrosky? Was the focus always on just removing him?
No. So there were two other conservative Christian members that were elected with Komrosky. And this PAC called the One Temecula Valley PAC went after all three of them, but Komrosky kind of came ahead in the signatures and they decided they were just going to go for Komrosky because he seems like the real firebrand of the bunch.
Hmm. And Aaron, this comes after two successful recall elections in the March primary, one in Orange County removing two school board members there, another in Woodland and Yolo County. What did we learn from those elections in March that might inform how we view what's happening in Temecula and going, you know, potentially to happen in Sunol?
Well, I think one thing that folks who are in favor of the recall learned is that that is a path. That's an avenue that works. And so I think that that is sort of the main actually takeaway is just, you know, and these are expensive races, these recalls. This is not like a small thing to be doing. And a lot of, you know, Sunol talks a lot about this. This is a very small district with just one school, 250 kids. You know, it's expensive. It's time consuming. It really distracts. Nobody really wants a recall. But that sort of shows you just how seriously these opponents to these folks take this is that they see this as sort of their only way, their only kind of attack that they have to kind of get in the way of what they see as really problematic policies. And so I think, yeah, what these previous recall shows is that that is an effective move.
I mean, it's incredible. If you drive through Sunol right now, it seems like every block has signs for the recall, against the recall. To your point, just a very small community.
Absolutely. It's taken over the entire community.
Yeah. All right. We're talking about the politics of school boards in California and some of the recall of board members now underway with Aaron Alday, reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, covering gender and sexuality, Madison Ahmet, reporter for KVCR in the Inland Empire, and Professor Jonathan Collins, associate assistant professor of political science and education at Teachers College, Columbia University. We're heading into a break. When we come back, we're going to dive into the details of the school debates in Temecula and Sunol and learn more about who is leading these recalls. And we'll take your calls. Stay with us.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, our guest is Justice Stephen G. Breyer. In 2022, after 28 years on the Supreme Court, Breyer was succeeded by Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. He'll talk to Sarah Isker on the occasion of his new book, Reading the Constitution, Why I Chose Pragmatism, Not Textualism. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures, here on KQED.
Coming up tonight at 10. Later this week on Forum, driverless cars. Are they exciting, annoying, dangerous, all of the above? We talk with the experts and hear from you. That's later this week on Forum, weekday mornings from 9 to 11, with an evening repeat from 8 to 10. The announcers and technical staff of KQED Radio are affiliated with the National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, CWA Local 51, AFL-CIO. The Forum rebroadcast continues at 9:20. This is KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Guy Marzorati in for Mina Kim. We're talking about the politics of school boards in California and some recall elections of board members now underway. We're with Aaron Alday, reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle covering gender and sexuality, Madison Ament, reporter for KVCR who's been following the recall happening in Temecula, and Jonathan Collins, assistant professor of political science and education at Teachers College, Columbia University. And we want to hear from you. Do you live in Sunol? Do you live in Temecula? What do you think about these recall elections happening there? Or maybe the ones that happened in March in Orange and Yolo counties? Has your local school board become more tense or political in recent years? We've seen that kind of play out throughout the state. And what issues are most important to you when you're voting for school board members? How do you decide who to vote for on the school board? You can email your comments and questions to forum at kqed.org or find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. We're at KQED Forum. And our phone lines are open, 866-733-6786. You can give us a call, 866-733-6786. So let's dive into some of the details of how we got here in Temecula and Sunol. And maybe, Madison, I'll start with you in Temecula. How did conservatives gain power on the local school board? What was that process like in 2022?
Yeah, so in the case of Temecula, the conservative members of the board were all backed by a church in the region called 412 and its PAC called the IE, Inland Empire Family PAC. Komrowski was elected with the two other conservative Christian candidates, and they're all really, they've been vocal about their Christian beliefs. And the PAC that helped elect them is also really vocal about wanting to elect conservative Christians to local government. That PAC actually held an NFL-style draft at the 412 church to select those candidates. And then Komrowski won with 54% of the vote. The other two Christian candidates won pretty solidly. And they almost had a fourth, but that person got beat out by just 25 votes. So it really took hold in Temecula.
And Aaron, what's your sense of like why this group, this PAC, decided to focus on school board seats?
Well, this all kind of harkens back to the pandemic, actually, probably before then. I mean, the leader of this 412 church is a pastor, Tim Thompson, and he's kind of active in the area for quite some time, but really kind of started getting people's attention again during the COVID time, during the shutdowns. He really spoke out about shutdowns affecting his church and masking requirements, and also got involved in the schools then and the school closures. And that was really what got him activated, what kind of got him on people's radar. That's true for a lot of these kind of conservative efforts and these parent groups. They really kind of got into action during COVID and the school closures. And then it carried over beyond that. You know, he kind of got a taste for it. And I think there was this sense of schools and school boards were sort of an entry point. This was a place where they could get people elected. They could get sort of conservatives. And partly it's because people aren't paying attention. A lot of school board races, they don't get a lot of votes. People in the past have just sort of tuned out, especially if you don't have kids in school. And so that was sort of considered, and I'm not saying that this was necessarily part of Pastor Tim's sort of plan, but this has been something played out kind of across the country. that this is sort of seen as an avenue, a path to kind of get into politics. And then schools, you know, this is a really important conservative touchstone, right? Like our kids and protecting our kids and this idea of parental rights. And so that really took off as this idea that we're protecting our kids and sort of this vulnerable space in these schools. And that's kind of the messaging that has sort of really blown up and gotten people elected, is sort of going after the so-called parental rights.
So the board wins a majority, conservative members win a majority on the board in 2022. Madison, then take us through what happens next. What's been kind of the timeline that led up to this election?
Well, Komorowski and the other two conservative members made up the majority, and they were able to do a lot really fast. At their first meeting, they banned critical race theory, even though it was never taught in the district. They wanted to pull an elementary social studies book because it mentioned gay civil rights leader Harvey Milk in its supplemental material. Komorowski called Milk a, quote, pedophile, and then that started a huge fight with Governor Gavin Newsom, who called Komorowski ignorant. Gavin Newsom threatened to fine the district $1.5 million, and then Newsom ended up actually buying those textbooks for the district. The board also passed a parental notification policy, like Aaron mentioned before. They banned all flags other than the U.S. and California flag. Again, opponents see that as sort of a ban on pride flags. The board gave themselves broad powers to just ban books that they deem obscene. And then the way that Komorowski specifically ran the meetings became an issue. He used yellow and red cards like a soccer referee. He kicked people out. At one point, he kicked the entire audience out. And then he was found to have violated the Brown Act. And then a lawsuit followed that cost the district $75,000. And then there were other lawsuits that are still costing that district money. So, I mean, all the while, Komorowski says that he's doing what he was elected to do. So,
yeah, let's actually, you talked to Komorowski recently. Let's hear a little bit about, you know, what he said.
I've just done what I said I was going to do. I'm a man of my word.
Okay, so Aaron, let's talk about that, because I think you hear this from these board members across the state who say, we won regular elections and this was our platform.
Yeah, I mean, they have a point. I mean, especially I think in Temecula and Murrieta and sort of this Inland Empire PAC is, yeah, they were pretty out front with what they were running on. And certainly, yeah, it shouldn't have been any surprise. And they did win, and they won by a lot. So, you know, people, this is what certainly a portion of this county, of this community wants. This is what they voted for. I will say that's not always the case. It's not always that people are you know, like in Sunol. And I'm, again, not saying that people are hiding any things or that, but in Sunol, it wasn't like they were running up there on these platforms of we're going to go in and really kind of make these big changes. So I feel like in Sunol, people felt like they were caught a little more off guard, whereas folks I talked to in Temecula were a little bit more like, we kind of saw this coming. We didn't know it was going to be quite this big.
What have been the impact that you've seen or heard from students, from teachers, as these policies have been passed in Temecula?
It's pretty brutal, honestly. As the teachers, especially that I talked to, it's been really stressful. The parental notification policies, just kind of the idea of those being put in place and teachers being put into a position where they have to kind of, you know, potentially validate or, you know, betray the kind of trust of these students, or they just, it really is concerning that this would even be on the table for a lot of teachers, and a lot of teachers feeling like they need to step up and they need to speak out and they need to kind of defend their students. And so that sort of is putting them in the line of fire. So this has, especially in Temecula, kind of turned into a teachers versus the board situation, where teachers really kind of get a lot of they carry a lot of the brunt of the attacks. And it's a weird position when you're like a lifetime teacher and all of a sudden you're being called a groomer and a pedophile and all these kind of names. And they really are shocked, a lot of them, by this. But, you know, so that for the teachers, I think a lot of them, it's been really hard. The students, it's hit and miss. A lot of students, if they're not LGBTQ or they're not necessarily part of that community, they might not. I mean, these are kids. They're not necessarily even then paying super close attention to school board politics. But LGBTQ kids in particular, queer kids, are they're feeling this. And even if these policies aren't put in place, they hear what people talk about. They hear what's being said about them and their community, especially these trans kids. They're very aware of it, and it's very upsetting even when these policies aren't in place.
Madison, what stands out to you that you've heard?
I mean, pretty much it's the same as what Aaron said. I've heard from a lot of teachers that they feel like these policies also violate their contract. So they feel like if I implement this policy, is my job at stake or will I lose my teaching credential? And then that has kind of manifested in like these conversations with Tony Thurmond, you know, talking about what are teachers supposed to do? They just aren't sure what they're supposed to do at this point because their contracts and these board policies are at odds with each other.
We're talking about the politics of school boards in California, an election today in Temecula, a recall election, another recall election coming up against two school board members in Sunol, Ryan Jurgensen and Linda Hurley. That's on July 2nd. And I want to turn back to you, Professor Jonathan Collins, to talk about, Aaron brought up this issue of the pandemic. And I think there's been a lot of discussion about whether we can draw a line from what's happening in these school board fights to what we saw over distance learning, what we saw over masking in some districts. What connection do you see there?
Well, I look and I see a perfect storm. And so a lot of what we're seeing with the culture wars and these specific issues that have become highly politicized in school board politics, you know, traces back to, you know, the creation of the publication of the 1619 Project by Nicole Hannah-Jones. And this happens in 2019. The pandemic happens. And so, you know, we have this massive move to remote instruction. And of course, there's a tremendous variation in the extent to which, you know, schools and districts are moving to remote instruction and how long they're staying on remote learning instruction orders. You know, in Temecula in particular, you know, we had Pastor Tim Thompson, who is one of the orchestrators of the rightward movement there, who was actually arrested for non-compliance with the stay-at-home orders during COVID. So you started to see a lot of the conservative messaging around protecting Christian and home values cultivating during the pandemic period. But not only do we see the idea of civil liberties being harnessed and cultivated and grown during the pandemic, we also have a pretty massive referendum on racial justice in America. And so the murder of George Floyd happens, and then the protests happen in result of that. And so the whirlwind of remote instruction, now parents are looking at what their kids are learning. The parents are literally peering into the classrooms through the laptop screens and in some cases and cell phone screens for their kids who are in schools. And then there's a national conversation about race happening in America. There's a national apology for America's racial history. And then you look up, and then in September, President Trump is making a speech about patriotic education, and he announces the creation of the 1776 Commission on Patriotic Education. And it was just basically this sort of public declaration that that conservatives need to protect the values of American education, that they are being ruined by liberal proselytizing. And, you know, from there, we start to see more and more of these culture war policies, especially as President Trump goes on to lose the 2020 presidential election. We start to see a big trickle down of the politics of this Patriotic Education Commission down into school board races.
And you pointed out at the beginning, you know, traditionally fights on school boards were over, you know, maybe charter schools, issues like that. Do you see any of that carrying over into these debates?
We see this happening primarily in your larger urban districts. So if you go to Chicago, if you go to Los Angeles, you come here to New York City, you'll still see those major debates about education reform, about accountability, these big sort of political battles between teachers' unions and these quote-unquote progressive reformers. That's still happening in places that are very densely populated. But what we've seen is the ground being covered in these smaller suburban and rural districts. These areas are being covered by this new sort of partisan culture war politics.
That's Professor Jonathan Collins from Teachers College, Columbia University. We're talking about special elections underway in California, school board fights across the state. And we're going to go to the phones now to Gregory in Oakland. Hey, Gregory.
Hi. First of all, I really appreciate this conversation. And as we take up these individual sort of situations and fights that are happening, I think it's important for us to understand and think about the big picture and the history at play here, because these individual scenarios are all part of a larger fight that public education is having right now. And when we start thinking about how national politics are influencing it, it's because historically we've taken advantage of moments like COVID, we've taken advantage of even the civil rights movement and the charter school movement, where I actually was a principal of an independent charter. All of these are being co-opted. These are well-intentioned designs that are being co-opted as a way of, you know, moving towards privatizing public education. And I think understanding how that larger fight and how that larger context is playing into this is really important for informing those who are voting, even in these recall elections.
Thank you so much, Gregory. Appreciate your call. And if listeners want to weigh in, if you have thoughts about what's going on in Sunol and Temecula or the bigger picture that Gregory brings up, you can send email comments and questions our way, forum@kqed.org. You can find us on social channels and Discord @KQED Forum, or give us a call now, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Aaron, what's your thought about how this debate that we're seeing in Temecula and Sunol perhaps ties to the debates we had here in San Francisco over pandemic learning, over, you know, broader fights over education? How much of this is a siloed debate versus maybe just the latest iteration?
You know, that's a little bit hard to say. I mean, I do think, you know, as the professor was saying, that there is this kind of direct line, this kind of direct, you know, carry through. I think one thing that is striking to me with a lot of these policies, especially, you know, looking at it from the kind of the LGBTQ perspective, is, you know, a lot of these feel very manufactured, right? Like they're kind of picking up these problems that don't exist. So, you know, something like the pride flag thing in Sunol, it came up in conversation supposedly because, you know, Linda Hurley was talking about being afraid that the district could be sued. You know, what would happen if the district was sued over a flag? And then Ryan Jurgensen, the other board member, said that he had had, you know, conversations from people in the community who were concerned about the pride flag or concerned about the flag. And so they, you know, they say the, as though these kind of come up organically, but the truth is, you know, nobody's ever sued Sunol over their flag. And I don't think that this was necessarily, you know, a top level concern for the school district. This was clearly, you know, just a way for them to kind of introduce this topic. I mean, that was just, it's very apparent that this is what they want to do. And it's same with, you know, what was interesting to me down in Temecula was talking about, I'm going to let you go there.
Well, you had a great anecdote in your story in the San Francisco Chronicle where I think you said 21 students had wanted to express a new gender out of
exactly
22,000 kids in the district.
So 21 out of 20,000. And not only that, but all but one of them came with their caregiver. So, I mean, the parents were part of that request. So one kid in 2 years out of 22,000 students made a request of a staff person for some sort of gender identity change, and they worked with that kid and they got the parents involved at some point. But that's the problem that they've identified that now has needs to be targeted with a policy and needs to cause this huge uproar.
You mentioned the, you know, politics playing out in Sunol around that flag restrictions. Was that in your mind kind of the main event leading us towards a recall in Sunol? What else kind of got us to this point where now two of the three board members will be on the ballot July 2nd?
Right. So I think the flag was sort of the turning point. There were some kind of concerns leading up to then, in that one of the board members in particular had brought up, sort of had raised it at meetings, sort of some concerns about books. She had gone to a neighboring school district to talk about book bans, to complain about like pornography and sort of the material that kids were being exposed to in that district, and that sort of set off red flags for kids and for parents and families in the Sunol district. And then it was kind of the same thing that they described down in Temecula, where it caused just a lot of chaos on the board, right? And so the board meetings after the flag ruling immediately just erupted into like everyone chaos. There's fighting, there's yelling. They have sheriff's deputies at every meeting now. They've cleared the room. It's the same kind of vibe now, and people are saying that this decision that they won't back down from has caused them to not be able to get any board business done. And I should should note also one thing that's come up is, for example, in Sinnoh, the superintendent resigned, and she said that she resigned in part because of everything that's been going on and all the pressure she's been under. And similarly, the superintendents down south have also either been resigned or forced out or fired.
Yeah, we've seen that commonality there. We are talking about school board recall elections in Riverside County and here in the Bay Area, and we're taking your calls, 866-733-6786. We're heading into a break. When we come back, will these recalls mark a turning point in California school board politics? And what do they mean for November? Stay with us.
Coming up tomorrow on Forum with guest host Leslie McClurg, Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, and Count Basie were as much a part of American culture as Coca-Cola and Mickey Mouse, says Larry Tai, author of a new biography of the three men. Known worldwide for their pioneering compositions and arrangements, Armstrong's, Ellington's, and Basie's popularity among white audiences would ultimately lay the foundation for the civil rights movement. Tai's new book is called The Jazz Men. Listen to Bass Forum shows by going to Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search KQED Forum.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Guy Marzorati in for Mina Kim. We're talking about the politics of school boards in California and some recalls of board members now underway with Erin Alday, reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, Madison Ament, reporter for KVCR in the Inland Empire, and Jonathan Collins, assistant professor of political science and education at Teachers College, Columbia University. And we want to hear from you. Do you live in Sinnoh? Do you live in Temecula? What do you think about the recalls? And what issues are important to you when you're voting for school board members? How do you decide who to vote for on the school board? You can email your comments and questions to forum@kqed.org. You can also find us on our social channels at KQED Forum, including Discord, our Discord community. Or give us a call right now, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. So let's talk a little bit about the pushback these conservative board members are facing and this organized pushback in the form of recall elections. Professor Collins, how would you kind of define this counter-mobilization that we're seeing?
Well, inevitable, I think, is the way that I would describe it, especially you look at the areas in which this is taking place. And so I think, again, if we travel back in time and we look at the last few election cycles, if we go back to 2020 and we go back to 2022 in particular, this is where we started to see this onslaught of conservative candidates who were entering school board races. And the national question, especially for the politics of education and the politics of school boards, centered around, well, what's going to happen when we have this conservative takeover of a school board? And because, again, this is unprecedented. We hadn't seen this kind of takeover before. The conservative politics of prior were centering around privatization and actually removing giving kids the ability or parents the ability to remove kids from the public school system. The idea that conservatives wanted to have a complete control over the schools, especially conservatives who are driven by sort of religious motivations. You know, again, this is something that is very new. And so, you know, big question swirled as to, well, how will these people govern? Because they were campaigning around things that they were going to look to abolish. And, you know, whether it's critical race theory, and again, to the earlier point, in places where critical race theory is not even being taught.
Right.
Questions around gender conformity and placing restrictions on the rights of transgender students in places that had hardly any transgender students at all. And so, like, how will you govern in a moment where you have to actually sort of deliver on campaign promises? And, you know, what we're starting to see is that, well, one, there are a slew of school board members, of these conservative board members, who have failed to deliver on those promises. But what we're seeing with these recalls are the consequences of some of these board members who actually have delivered. The problem heading into these debates was, well, the issues that they were championing were overall quite politically unpopular. you know, there was a subset of Americans who agreed and supported these ideas. But in the grand scheme, all the polling data was suggesting that, you know, opposition to critical race theory, restricting the rights of transgender students, book bans, all these things are very politically unpopular. And so when I see what's happening in Temecula and I see what's happening in Sonoma, it's hard to look at it as anything but an inevitability.
Hmm. We're going to go to the phones now and Bud in South Riverside County. Bud, good morning and thanks for calling in.
Good morning and thank you very much. What I'm concerned about is the use of the term conservative, because from everything I know and define as conservative is the exact opposite of what we're seeing in these movements that are being commonly called conservative. And I think if there was more clarity in the use of the term, we'd be able to make some progress in increasing knowledge on this. I think what we're talking about really are radicals, not conservatives. They are really defying what has been established for decades in many respects. And I think that that obscures the ability to get into the issue in a meaningful way.
Thanks so much, Bud. I appreciate that. And Madison, I think this is a great question for you as you've been covering the campaign to recall Komorowski. To what extent are organizers kind of adopting some of the points that Bud are making and maybe painting this as something not just conservative or liberal, but something out of bounds politically?
Yeah, I think first the word conservative is something that Komorowski, for instance, uses. He self-defines as conservative. But I think in Temecula, this PAC that's really pushed the recall, they say they want good governance and that it goes beyond political affiliation. They want nonpartisan school board members that they feel like would represent their community better. And that's not just politically, but just meeting behavior. And then, you know, not passing policies that are going to cost the district thousands, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars. So what these opponents of particularly the Temecula Conservative School Board members are saying is we just want tamer people in office.
Hmm. Let's hear a little bit from a supporter, Jeff Pack, who's been helping to organize the recall against Komorowski in Temecula.
His demeanor and behavior, it's just no way fits the position. And you can see the damage being done on day one.
And Madison, I've heard this, from organizers in Sonol who in some cases try to downplay the policies that they're criticizing board members for and saying, you know, this is about behavior. This is about decorum and demeanor at board meetings. Are you hearing that from organizers in Temecula? And do you think in perhaps what Pack is saying is an attempt to have a broader appeal that, hey, even if no matter how you feel about these policies, the way that board meetings are being carried out is objectionable?
Yeah, I think they are. I think PAC specifically and the people associated with the One Temecula Valley PAC are really saying that. That more broadly, they're arguing that this school board member is violating laws. You know, he's been found to have violated the Brown Act, and they're arguing that it's not just the policies, but it's that he's not doing his job correctly. And that if you don't do your job well, you would get fired in most situations. And that's sort of why they've pushed the recall.
We have a question from listener David who writes, quote, I've heard the only reason Komorowski is open to recall is because opponents were not able to get enough signatures for the other two board members. If this is true, what does it say about the ideology of the county's population? Is the majority against the ideology of the school board? If the other two conservative members remain on the board, will it be possible to reverse the policies that have been passed? Madison, what can you tell us about David's questions?
Well, first, there were three conservative board members. And then late last year, Danny Gonzalez, one of those members, vacated his seat to move to Texas. So actually, right now, there's only two on the board, Jen Wiersma and Joseph Komorowski. And I think that, sorry, could you ask the question again?
Oh, sure. So I think part of David's question is, does the ideology of the district or maybe the political leanings of the district favor what the board has done if they were only able to qualify a recall against one out of the three members? But it sounds like there might have been more to that.
Yeah, I think it's kind of up in the air right now. I think that Temecula and more broadly Riverside County is a very purple area, and there's a lot of different political ideologies there. But, you know, Komorowski came out with way more signatures when they were looking for the recall. And the other two candidates won pretty handedly in their races. So I think that there's a possibility that, you know, Temecula wants to keep these conservative Christians in power on their school board.
We have a comment from listener Tater on Discord who writes, conservatives and Republicans have been extremely effective in taking over local politics, much more so than Democrats and others on the left. Professor Collins, this is a question I've been thinking about in the context of these recalls. Where is the Democratic Party in all of this?
Well, I would push back against that. I wouldn't say that Republicans and conservatives have been more effective at taking over school boards. I would say that we just have a very strong spatial divide in America. And if you go to, again, more urban and densely populated areas, you find Democrats have an extremely strong grip over the politics of education. You know, it gets more and more complex politically and ideologically and from a partisan standpoint the more you get into sort of suburban and rural areas. What's happening here is not just that Republicans have some sort of stronger political strategy. What you're also seeing is like the diminishing of purple areas. You know, people are more likely than ever to live in places where people politically agree with them. And as the country becomes more and more segregated by partisanship and ideology, the natural manifestation of this is political opportunity for both parties in those specific areas where people are concentrating ideologically.
Hmm. One force that we have seen across these recalls elections in California is the role of teacher unions supporting the recalls, oftentimes putting forth the bulk of the financial resources. Professor, is that something that you've seen nationwide as we think about this counter-mobilization?
Well, so that's an interesting a question, an idea, because this actually starts back with the parents' right movements that happens in Los Angeles. And so L.A. was really interesting because you started to see this big parent rights resistance in a district that is, you know, extremely liberal, extremely blue. And the movement happens around the idea of reopening schools. And to the extent that we started to see some sort of blurring between a political movement that captured both Democratic and Republican parent interest, it seemed to be the school reopening process and the reaction to the COVID-19 protocol. Mm-hmm. And so what's happening now is that not only are these areas propping up where we're seeing this alignment amongst parents, well, this creates a consorted resistance against them. And, you know, teachers unions, who are the primary advocate for teachers as laborers, have had to step in and push back against, you know, those efforts. You know, at the heart of this is an important question is, you know, are we starting to devalue teachers more and more? You know, Phi Delta Kappan does an annual survey where they look at people's attitudes towards various aspects of our education system. And they've been measuring over time the extent to which they feel teachers should be heavily involved in determining curricula. And we're starting to see a decline in support for that idea. Trust in teachers is declining. Teachers leaving the workforce is increasing. You know, and so I think the teachers union in particular feels compelled to jump in and support any kind of localized political movement that is in sort of infringing on the ability for teachers to do their job or just making their jobs more difficult and more complicated.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Guy Marzorati, in for Mina Kim. And we're talking about recall elections against school board members, happening one today in Temecula and Riverside County, another coming up July 2nd in Sunol in the Bay Area. And we're joined by Aaron Alday, reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, covering gender and sexuality, Madison Ament, a reporter for KVCR in the Inland Empire, and Jonathan Collins, assistant professor of political science and education at Teachers College, Columbia University. We have a time left for maybe a couple more calls, so if you have something on your mind about these recall elections, give us a call, 866-733-6786. And we have Karen in Oakland. Thanks so much for calling. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to circle back to a previous caller's comment with regard to the privatization of schools, to just take it a step further to suggest that to the extent that we can think of privatization not only in the economic sense, we can think about the reason why these school districts may seek to do exactly what they're doing, which is to diminish marginalized voices in effort to maintain power and control. Schools are the primary point of indoctrination for tomorrow's citizens, and by diminishing the voice of children that are not heterosexual, that have gender diversity, racial diversity, taking those books off shelves, you other those children. You don't give the opportunity for white students to learn about difference. They don't have the opportunity to develop into global citizens that are empathetic to difference. Instead, they become leaders that are just like leaders from the 1930s, 40s that had us in a segregated Jim Crow circumstance that centers homogenous whiteness. And I think that's really ultimately what's undergirding this entire movement across the country. The book bans and on and on and on. It's indoctrination into white supremacy, a return to the past. Keep America great again. That's my comment.
Thank you so much for that comment, Karen. We really appreciate you calling in. Professor Collins, I'm also thinking about some of the structures of these elections in these districts that we have. Temecula, they elect board members by district. It's a small district that might lead to more neighborhood representation, but you also need fewer votes to win. I mean, what are some of the structural issues that may lead us to these kind of bifurcated and fights on boards?
Well, so when you're getting at this idea of the ward-based representation model that you see in Temecula, you know, every institutional design has trade-offs, I think is the best way to think about it. You know, there are advantages to the ward-based system that you have in a place like Temecula. And the advantage here is that you get more localized representation. So the people who are serving as board members should, in theory, be very representative of the sort of micro communities around them versus just being more at-large representatives who would be more so inclined to think about their responsibility as the city or the entire district as their constituency. And so from a neighborhood perspective, it is very good to have ward-based representation. The problem becomes the incentive to coordinate with other members from other wards is much lower because, you know, you gain political points by being aligned with the preferences or ideas of your community. And if we have a specific micro community that thinks very differently or is very segregated both in identity and in thought from other communities, well, then the opportunity for compromise and for common ground becomes slimmer and slimmer. And so that's why you see the more concerted political effort that we saw in Temecula. It was not enough to have one board member representing these more conservative values. They needed a larger takeover of the school board in order to produce any kind of policy reform. Now, that's good in the sense that the threshold for major reform is high, but it's bad in the sense that it creates some incentive for political operatives to pursue this sort of larger takeover to begin with.
Aaron, got about 30 seconds here to the end of the hour. What are you watching going forward? Do you feel like these recalls could be a turning point in this discussion or maybe just a setup for what we'll see in November?
Oh, I think I'm paying real close attention because I do think that these will, you know, I think we're going to see more of these. And I do think that these school boards especially are going to be a huge factor in November. So, I mean, maybe these individual recalls don't necessarily mean a lot, you know, beyond their immediate community. But everybody has their eyes on November and not just on the presidential election, but on these school boards.
That's Aaron Allday, reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, covering gender and sexuality. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us here this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Also heard from Madison Ahmet, reporter for KVCR, who's been following that election in Temecula. Thank you, Madison.
Thank you, Guy.
And Jonathan Collins, assistant professor of political science and education at Teachers College, Columbia University. Professor, really appreciate your time and your insight this morning.
Thank you, Guy. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to Forum. Thanks also to all the listeners who called in, who wrote in. And we will continue to follow these elections today in Temecula, July 2nd in Sanol. I'm Guy Marzorati, in for Mina Kim, and you've been listening to Forum.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the